Welcome to Linux Mint Radio by Kansas, the podcast for embedded Linux developers who want to simplify and speed up their custom platform development. Visit kansas.com today for access to our podcast archives.
Welcome back to Linux Mint Radio. Machi Haas on this end, and I have two of our Linux engineers with me today, Jason Woodward and Daniel Schaefer. Today we're going to spend a lot of time talking about build systems and how you can very quickly create a complete Linux platform and customize that platform to specific needs that you have in the project. We're also going to tackle one of the questions that we have received from one of our listeners. It's about responsiveness and latency of a Linux kernel when moving from microkernel solution to Linux. But before we start today, I have one very sad news to share with all of you. A member of our Linux Link Radio family, Rick Rubenis, has recently passed away. Rick's been suffering from Hodgkin's lymphoma disease, and we are very saddened of losing him. He's been a very important member of our team here, looking after the quality of the audio that we produce here. So all that good quality podcast episode that you've listened so far have been mixed by Rick. Our condolences to Rick's family. Rest in peace, our friend. I wanted to tackle the primary topic of our today's podcast, which is build systems. And unlike with other previous podcasts, I'm going to break the rule today, and I'm going to start by talking a bit about Linux Link and the factory. The reason why I'm going to do that is because a lot of our listeners and people that I talk to typically don't associate Linux Link radio podcast with the factory or what we do here at Kansas. So I wanted to take 5 minutes and introduce briefly our product, and I'm going to solicit your help, guys, in defining what it really does. But the primary product that we offer is called Linux Link, and part of it is factory. Can you talk a bit about the factory product? What is it, and how it's helping customers achieve the goal?
Sure. Our factory product is an end-to-end build system for development of a custom Linux platform. It has an offline local desktop build, as well as an online version for people that just want to get started quickly, just want to download something fast, or want to customize something without making a full commitment to setting up a local desktop development environment.
So it's Linux Link provides Linux code. That's a given. It's open source, and Linux Link is very much aligned with open source, but it also provides Built Engine, and this is part of the topic that we're going to tackle today. Built Engine that allows customers to build their custom Linux platform from grounds up. So you can start small with a handful of packages, and very quickly build a toolchain, root file system, and a kernel that match specific requirements that you have in your project.
That's right. Starting from your kernel to just a small set of minimal things to get a working root file system for a Linux platform, and then from there you can start adding application or any kind of libraries that your application requires.
Mm-hmm. So we have online system, which helps assemble a starting point, but we also have a desktop system with which you can swap the Linux kernel, completely bring in your own code, add additional packages from third-party vendors.
Can use the same tools that you build as well as your local development.
You can also very quickly bundle your application with the root file system, so a very easy path to deployment, right, as defined through those tools. But what's the most, I think, interesting to our customers is that it's all open source. It's a build engine that has been based, the design of it, on open source technologies. And you've been involved in the process of building the build engine yourself. So if you can, in a few words, talk a bit about the heart of the build engine, the desktop factory, and why is it so powerful?
Well, it's based around Make and around the central idea that we wanted to have a definition for our platform. Mm-hmm. We wanted to be able to take that definition and feed it into the build system and have repeatable builds. Nothing should change unless that definition file changed. And it's really interesting idea to have that single file definition of what should be included in your platform. And we built a configuration framework around that using the kconfig system, which is the kernel configuration system used by the Linux kernel and other projects like BusyBox, UCLibc, UBoot, etc. Mm-hmm.
So it's a very familiar to a Linux engineer interface and very easy to work with. And where do the sources come from? So I have my build engine on a host Linux platform, and now I'm trying to build a custom Linux. Where do the sources come from?
Well, if you
assume that there's no web interface, you just have the offline build engine, the desktop factory, mm-hmm. And you try to build your custom platform. Is there like a server?
We here at Kansas have a repository server that's available to the public, so if you have your factory build system on a development machine, you can pull directly from our servers. You don't have to worry about someone's source forge page going, being closed, or a specific older version of a specific open source project not being available. We cache all those things, and the factory build system creates a local cache after the initial pull, so anything that you add to your platform, it pulls from us on demand, and then you have a local cache there that you can point to from subsequent builds or internal builds.
So it's actually a very nice way of managing your custom Linux platform on your host PC at your location.
That's right.
And Kansas is there to back you up with tested sources that have been verified to work with each other, so we're looking after cross-dependencies and feature functionality of those packages. But also there's an update service that's associated with the factory concept, right, which alerts you ahead of time. Preemptively.
It actively alerts you. So basically when we create an update, it'll go out and email to you, you don't have to proactively go and look for those updates yourself.
Right, and then you can decide whether that update is something that's relevant to your project, or if you want to skip on it. Right. So enough of the shameless commercial. Let's talk more
generally.
the purpose of Linux Link Radio really is to introduce a number of concepts that Linux engineers face on a daily basis. You're right, Daniel, that this particular conversation is a nice beginning to today's podcast, where we want to talk about build systems. And let's talk first about requirements. Jason, you've mentioned a couple of them already, like the fact that you want to have a repeatable build system that can build everything on demand from source code on a host platform. Mm-hmm. And you want to be able to rebuild that platform at any point in the future,
right,
and have the exact same binaries.
Yeah, very important.
What other requirements would you say are important when someone looks at adopting a build system?
Well, you want to see how well it fits into your environment. You don't want to have to reshape your internal workflow to fit around a build system. You want something that's flexible and take into consideration your environment, your needs, and your specific infrastructure. Mm-hmm. You may have requirements from IT that doesn't let you gain outside access to the network.
And typically, companies that work with Linux, they have some sort of source code management control system that they probably use, right?
Right.
So there's a couple of them that are most popular in the Linux world, right? I know Subversion.
Git
is the second one.
I see a lot of customers with Perforce.
CVS, I'm not sure if it's still alive.
No, it is. Okay. It's hard to kill.
Okay, so those are definitely some of the aspects that companies look at when they try to select the right build engine for their Linux project.
They're typically going to have their entire development cycle built around this, right? They're going to have nightly build set up. They're going to have developers on their local machine customizing or maybe branching things and trying out new avenues of development that may not be accepted company wide. But you know, you need to have a tool that can not only satisfy your nightly build requirements, but can also help those developers as they're working on the desktop, whether it's for the kernel or specific application.
Right. And a few other aspects that you brought up earlier, which is you want to be able to build small first, mm-hmm. and then as your application requirements clarify or change,
right.
you can very easily modify your Linux platform to meet those needs.
Right. It's very important to have the ability to incrementally modify your platform or iteratively or however, whatever process you have internally.
And given that we work with embedded Linux here, I think the footprint of the overall solution is also important, right? So yeah. not only you start with fewer packages, but also you want to have ability to optimize images that the build engine builds for you.
That's right. Right. Well, that's pruning or just generic stripping all the binaries or whatever scheme you have. And it's also typically a lot easier to create a smaller FS if you build up from the bottom down and from the top up.
Yeah.
So what happens is if you just grab a large distribution from someone and start developing your app, you'll start pulling in all kinds of different libraries that you really may not need, but since they're there, you use them. And then when you realize that it's not a thing, your footprint, you go back and start stripping things out. It becomes much harder to create a very small footprint or FS. And that makes your quality assurance testing a lot more complicated. If you accidentally remove something in the guise of making it smaller, then all of a sudden, you know, your QA nightly tests are failing and you have to go back and say, okay, who changed what when?
Yeah. You want to also have ability to very quickly and easily integrate third-party software, right. whatever you develop or whatever you already are using in-house. And do you have preference to use that over open source packages that Panthus provides or you get from other open source projects?
Mm-hmm.
The build engine, whatever it is, should allow you to do that.
Right. You may get some binary-only codecs, for example, from
right, exactly. Yeah. So another aspect is ease of deployment, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
So today, there are different devices that have different needs for how they are formatted for deployment. Some of our companies build devices that use stage booting approach. Some of them keep the images completely in a some sort of flash. Others, on the other hand, have enough power to have a hard drive attached mm-hmm. to the board, right? So different ways in which you should be able to format the final images for deployment.
You should be able to take whatever your build system spits out, whether you need a file system image, like a JFS2 or full-blown, like EXT3 or 4 or 2, whatever you have is your final output for your target, should,
mm-hmm.
your build system should help you to get that format.
Yeah, actually, I'm going to mention here, I guess, one of the experiences that I had, which was a company that was using an open source build system, but they wanted to, they were working with custom hardware, which most of our customers are people that try to adopt Linux for embedded systems built, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if that's the case, the first component that's going to change is Linux kernel. So how easy it is to swap a Linux kernel or to reconfigure the Linux kernel and plug it into your Linux platform and have it rebuild consistently with the rest of Linux components.
Right. Without foregoing the benefit of the build system, if you can't actually configure the build system to do that,
right.
then you have a split development effort where you're using the build system for the RFS, but then your kernel is a separate activity.
And that's a hassle to maintain. I think that we've been, I've been, as a, in my previous life, in a situation like that where I had to build a binary package for something and then marry it with a number of other packages that were completely incompatible.
Yeah.
And when you're facing the challenge, oh well, that's difficult.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk a bit about options. What are different systems that you can find out there that you can consider for as a build system for your next Linux project? And we've mentioned already Factory, right? Desktop 3, and we see a lot of customer interest in because of feature functionality that it offers and flexibility. We got a nice award for our online and offline Factory at the Freescale Technology Forum, so we're very proud of that. But now that we're on topic of Freescale, they also offer a build system that is more of a board support package delivered with a number of their reference platforms to customers, and it's a system called Alpit. You guys have probably, between the two of you, like years of experience with Alpit. So why don't you share with us your experience? Is it proprietary? How is it licensed?
No, it's basically, it's an open source project that's pretty much supported by Freescale.
Okay.
I really haven't seen any other community build up around it besides
mm-hmm.
basically Freescale supporting it.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, it's primarily for Freescale processors.
Okay. But what is it? Is it really a build system or is it a BSP?
Well, it's both. Freescale ships it with their boards as a BSP, but it's also a build system
uh-huh.
That ships with a binary toolchain and basically allows you to build your kernel, all your packages, and your RFS for specific boards.
Mm-hmm. So is it pre-configured for a platform when it's delivered to a customer?
Typically, yes. So it basically all comes pre-configured with the settings that Freescale has for the default BSP.
Okay.
Basically, it's kind of a kconfig-based system that also uses some Perl on top of it, and
mm-hmm.
they wrap the kconfig system with Perl.
Okay.
And then underneath all that, they also use the RPM packaging format for building their packages.
So Alpit is RPM-based, and it comes with a binary toolchain, doesn't build the toolchain from scratch, so you can't optimize really the toolchain itself if you'd like to specify additional flags. Okay. In terms of C library support, I think that this is also some of the differentiating factors for some of the build systems, but I think that Alpit supports both, right? Both UCWT and GWT?
Mm-hmm. Builder is one that doesn't. It's UCWT specific. It doesn't have GWT support.
So let's talk about Buildroot. Buildroot is also kconfig-based,
mm-hmm.
right? So there are a lot of similarities between those two many different build systems out there. But Alpit and Buildroot in particular, they share a lot of common points, and so does Factory.
It's such a common interface that people are just so at home with it. It just makes sense to eat. Yeah,
but again, kconfig interface is just a graphical portion that exposes the choices or options to whoever's using the build system, right? So that's what kconfig means in this case. So Buildroot, you mentioned that it's UCWT only. Why?
It was actually created as a way to create UCWT-based systems, since it was so hard initially to create UCWT toolchain. They created Buildroot as a way to create UCWT-based RFS.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of grows from there, just adding naturally, adding packages and things like that.
Yeah, so I know that there's one package in particular that Buildroot spun around, which was BusyBox,
mm-hmm.
right? BusyBox and a couple of libraries, and you have a root file system, and that's, I guess, a starting point for Buildroot and also Desktop Factory.
Mm-hmm.
But is it limiting the fact that you're using, that you have to use UCWT as opposed to GWT?
Well, you have specific requirements, so we kind of touched on it earlier. Like, if you have a proprietary binary, only codecs you're getting from your semiconductor partner, you kind of have to use GWT if it was built against GWT. A lot of people now for the PowerPC architecture are using eGWT,
right.
Which has some of the benefits of eGWT in terms of being able to pare down the size compared to GWT, but they're still, which is, they're binary compatible as well as ADF metal. There's a lot of reasons why you may not be able to use eGWT and you have to use, such as internationalization.
I see.
If you really want to do internationalization, you're probably much better off using GWT or better support for eGWT than you will use eGWT.
So Buildroot does come with a toolchain? Oh, that's built the toolchain.
It builds the toolchain as part of the stack. Okay. The toolchain's internal to the function of
Android. Is it a build system or is it an SDK? I'm going to keep on asking those questions throughout, but...
It's a build system.
It's more of a build system.
It's hard to extract out toolchain from build root to use just as a SDK toolchain to hand out to developers or maybe someone who you want to provide an SDK for your platform, like any of your customers. Right. It's kind of hard to do with build root.
Right, but it also has a closed pool of packages that come with it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's also a problem with Elton as well, is that it has a limited set of packages with it.
So it depends on, it depends on what type of application you're building, whether any of those build systems might make sense to your project, right? If you have a requirement for, let's say, graphics packages that are not in a pool of packages supported by build root, or not, that you have to go through another route, right? Either find a different build system or find a way to bring those into those build systems. But is it difficult to modify those build systems?
Well, build root luckily isn't that hard. It's based on make. It doesn't make it very easy. You have to really look at every step of there's not a real framework that you can adopt.
Yeah.
So Elton, you have to generate spec files.
So there's a pretty much learning curve that everyone has to go through.
Right. If you're not a maker, then you have a hard time with a build root. If you're not a spec file, maker, you have a hard time with
Elton. That sounds like a maintenance nightmare too.
Yeah.
Let's talk about one other build system that is different from the two that we've mentioned. Let's talk about Open Embedded, and in particular, one of the distributions that uses Open Embedded called Angstrom, right? So what's the difference between, or is it the other way around? Yeah, it's Open Embedded and Angstrom is a distribution, right?
Yeah, Open Embedded is basically kind of a generic build system.
Yeah.
Several people actually have adopted it, one of them being Angstrom.
Okay. So what's so different or special about Open Embedded? Does it meet the different criteria that we've outlined at the beginning of the podcast?
Well, it's more of a distribution builder than really a platform build system.
Okay.
If you're looking to build something like a large community like the Angstrom developers have done, and or anything like that, then yes, it's got infrastructure for that, certainly.
Yeah, I know that Angstrom offers the pool of packages for Angstrom is far larger than the pool of packages for build root.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But at the same time,
it's very package-centric, that's the point. Right? So it's meant to be packages, and it's not a platform, it's not a holistic platform approach, it's very much package-centric.
So you're talking about Open Embedded now. All right, so Open Embedded is package-centric, not the platform-centric, and platform in terms of toolchain, root file system, and the external. But it also uses a different build engine under the cover. It's not K-config, right? What is it?
Bit.
Okay, so what are we baking?
So basically, we're taking recipe files, kind of similar to what other build systems do with kconfig files, to a very different format, and basically baking them to produce all the packages.
Okay, so in scale of 1 to 10, and I think that make approach, kconfig / make approach, is on a scale of difficulty at the level of maybe 3 or 4, where does bit-bake approach fit?
To me, I would say 8, but it's partly because it's a different technology. A lot of make isn't necessarily the easiest thing to use, right. But everyone has to use make, so everyone gets used to it and learns it.
Well, and I want to mention here that, Daniel, you've been working with Linux for how long?
8 or 9 years.
Okay, so no more comments, okay? Well, I looked at bit-bake.
Just keep it relative. Relatively speaking, it's a lot more arcane than just the regular make syntax.
Well, and I think that the learning curve is steeper, and the maintenance of the build system is also higher. I think as far as flexibility of it is concerned, I'd imagine that if you want to add your own package to the pool, it's a more involving process,
right? Or you can customize what's already in the pool.
Yeah.
For example, if you have no need for specific library support, if you're really trying to pare down, for example, you have no use for Kerberos authentication, then you're going to have a tough time paring that down. There's a lot of bit-bake recipes that you have to touch to kind of get that thing.
So not only are you working with open source packages from open source projects, but you also have to learn how to define a recipe for bit-bake,
right,
to bake that recipe
and
then open it.
Amongst all the existing recipes.
Yeah, but I want to point out that we're not trying to bash here any of the build systems, even though it might sound like this so far.
Right.
But Open Embedded, and in particular Angstrom, they've been used in the past at least to manufacture a good demos. I've seen Linux demos with Angstrom on it, running on a number of ARM platforms.
Yeah.
They do provide GTK packages, a number of open source graphics packages, which other build systems don't. Open source build systems. If you bake a recipe that's pretty fine, it's probably a fairly straightforward process.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to build your custom recipe, that's a more involving process, and maintenance is high.
And that's what it's all about. I mean, as an embedded developer, you pretty much own your project, so you're gonna be getting into the guts of any build system, no matter what it is. So extensibility and customization ability are very much on the top of your list when you're looking at and evaluating these things. If you need a starting point, or you just need something to slap in at your flashing window, those kind of distributions are great, because not only is the package pool huge, but a lot of people are using it as well.
Right, and that's what the Factory does as well. Right? We're not trying to get our own packages or build the packages in an unusual way for our customers. Those are all open source packages. It's just that they are proven to work with each other,
mm-hmm,
compile with each other, all the cross dependencies are resolved. And what's nice about Best of Factory, and I think that Jason, you have put that feature in it, is that packages are dynamically configured based on other selections.
Yeah.
That helps in keeping the footprint of a given package to a minimum based on what other packages are needed.
On your selection,
and your Linux platform.
So if you have A and B selected, and A can certainly be enhanced by B, then it notices that and automatically turns that feature on.
Excellent. All right, so one last topic here on build engines. It's actually a question for you. In terms of updates, how active are those different projects that we've mentioned? Are they constantly updated? Do you guys see that package versions are changing in those projects? I know that Elton, since it's more of a BSP approach, the packages change less frequently.
Mm-hmm. And different between processors as well.
And they're different between processors. But I'm curious about build root and Angstrom.
Well, at least with build root, there's no scheduled release. There's no release. You're pretty much checking something out of their version control system. So as long as you know what version you have, that's the most important focal point, is what version you have. If you're having a problem, have you tested against trunk? Which is one of those common things that you hear when you're asking for support. You'll get back, try this with the newest version.
Right.
And it's community-based, so you're looking on mailing list or IRC.
Yeah. That other distributions that I'm not sure if I can consider embedded Linux distributions. Well, one of them is, and it's ELDK. ERBK has been used heavily in the past, at least on PowerPC platforms. Any specific points you wanted to bring up about ERBK? Is it a distribution or is it a build system?
Well, it's more of a distribution. It's a binary-only thing. If you have that concern, you can't just take something binary off the shelf. You're going to have a hard time with that.
Right. No building from source? Okay. So that's actually what I was looking for.
Well, it's not easy. I should qualify that.
Okay.
It's responsible.
But there's a manual process involved.
It's not part of the actual workflow builds.
What about more of a mainstream distributions? And I'm thinking here Red Hat, I'm thinking, Fedora maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Debian. Mm-hmm. What do you guys think about those distributions in the embedded space?
Well, in the small device space, certainly those distributions are really hard to get small. So if you are of the luxury where space and memory are not an issue for you, then they can certainly give you that quick starting point.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of the points of customization and being able to do something that, specific for your application, something that differentiates you from your competitors, it becomes a lot harder.
How about architecture support? I know that
Something like Debian, it's going to be very limited. So, it's going to be support 11 or 13, 14, it's flustering. Yeah, I should say limited when it goes to embedded.
Right, exactly.
So they have support for ARM and a lot of more server and desktop architectures. But it's not going to, you're not going to get like Cortex-A support directly from. Right, you're gonna get ARM V5 or 4L support. You just switch to, let me just create a new EAVI port.
Okay.
So you can run their packages on ARM 7, but you're not going to get the performance increase.
I see. So you won't be able to optimize your overall solution if you use those distributions. But at that point, you guys made it already. It's a top-down approach versus bottom-up,
right?
Which for embedded space
can
be a killer.
Yeah, can make things very difficult.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think it was a very interesting discussion. I wanted to also tackle at least one of the questions that we've received from one of our listeners. And the question that I'm going to bring up here is about the responsiveness and latencies that one should expect from Linux kernel when you move from a microkernel approach and moving your entire solution into Linux. And we're not going to talk about the reasons why you want to eventually move from microkernel to Linux. Let's talk about what kind of responsiveness latency, what can you expect from Linux when you move your application. And I know that you've been working with real-time patches in the past, 2.6 Linux kernel enhanced for real-time. When we talk about responsiveness latencies, that's what immediately comes to my mind. I'm not sure if I'm correct or not, but I always thought that real-time is going to help with the latencies. Am I correct?
It's going to help with your worst-case latencies.
Okay.
So basically, it puts a limit on what your worst-case latency is. But in doing that, it's going to slow down your throughput, so it might not make your machine necessarily faster.
Okay. So there was this concept, feature of the Linux kernel, that no matter how small you wanted to sleep in the past, the smallest period of time that you could sleep was 100 milliseconds?
Yeah, that's actually increased on x86 processors. So it's basically the tick rate of the timer that gets used.
Okay.
So basically, if you said you wanted to sleep for some very small amount of time, you would sleep at least until, your worst-case sleep could be as long as the tick. So it basically would limit the timing resolution your application can have.
So timing resolution in Linux kernel, let's talk briefly about it. So that's been a challenge in a 2.4 Linux kernel days. It's been a challenge in 2.6 Linux kernel days, at least early kernel days. But I thought that there was a solution to it in form of high resolution timers. So what do high resolution timers do for end user?
They basically allow you to use the native resolution of the timer on your processor.
So can I assume that I'm going to have my application sleep for a number of microseconds that I schedule it for?
Yes.
Right, so that's
using those timers.
Now, how does scheduling come into play here? So if I have a high resolution timer enabled in the Linux kernel, and I want to schedule my task, my application yields, and how soon will I get a control back? I mean, is it that the latency of the scheduler is also going to be bound by high resolution timer, or not necessarily?
It's going to be a number of things, right? So it's going to depend on the priority of your task and what else is running.
Okay.
It's going to depend on interrupt latency from when that high resolution timer interrupt fires until it actually can dispatch that interrupt.
Okay. Will it also depend? I mean, would real-time paths help here?
Yes.
In what way?
Well, basically, it puts a lot more points in the kernel where it will reschedule.
Mm-hmm.
And it also changes most of the locking primitives in the kernel so that they can be preempt them, basically.
Mm-hmm. So you can get latency responsiveness that is at the level of microseconds. And I know that depends from architecture, right?
It depends on architecture, the speed of the processor. So on something like a 200 MHz ARM5, you might get, 200 microseconds, somewhere around that range.
Yeah.
And it's also, you kind of almost need to differentiate between responsiveness and latency.
Right.
Because responsiveness, typically, if you want something really responsive, like a graphical user interface that you can use right away,
yeah,
you actually don't want a real-time system.
Okay.
Because you don't care if once in a while it takes a while to return,
yeah,
if the majority of the time it's really fast.
Right.
Because by adding in these limits on the latency, you're actually slowing down your throughput.
That's right.
And you're actually slowing down responsiveness.
Yep.
Right?
So
you're making the system slightly slower.
So your point is that when you employ real-time in your system, you get overall better worst-case responsiveness or latency of the system, but at the same time you increase the throughput or lower the throughput by increasing the overhead of any task that gets scheduled in the system. Makes a lot of sense. Well, I'm not sure if we've answered our listeners' question. Hopefully yes. But if not, please send us another email, and we're going to try to at least address the remaining questions there. Well, I think it was an interesting conversation today. Thank you very much, guys, for your time.
Thank you, sir.
And I'm looking forward to the next recording. Hopefully, I'm sure that we're going to record the next podcast in the next 2 or 3 weeks. Thanks again for today.
Thanks.
This podcast is brought to you by Kinesis. Are you new to embedded Linux? Looking for a way to simplify your next project? The Linux Link service by Kinesis makes it easy to build your custom embedded Linux platform. Go to kinesis.com today or call 866-392-4897 to learn more.